Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Today's episode is a part of The Realignment's daily series covering the big themes that drove 2022. If you're enjoying these daily episodes and would like to support the work the team's putting in this month, go to realignment.supercast.com or click the link in the show notes in your podcast player where you can subscribe for a monthly, yearly, or lifetime membership. I just got back from Boston, which was the close of our East Coast tour. We did a show in New York on Tuesday and then that Boston show last night. So I'm excited that I'm going to have more time to put into the newsletter. So if you'd like to subscribe to the Substack, the show link is also available in the podcast notes as well. Today's episode is all about supply chains. I'm speaking with James Rickards. He's the author of a new book, Sold Out: How Broken Supply Chains, Surging Inflation, and Political Instability Will Sink the Global Economy. Hope you all enjoy this conversation. And of course, a huge shout out to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. See you all next week. James Rickards, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you, Marshall. Great to be with you.
You have this useful line in the book that kind of gets at the definitional question. A supply chain isn't an object. It's a process. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are so many links in the supply chain. So just to give a really simple example, say you go to the store and you want to get a loaf of bread, and there's the loaf of bread. And you say to the individual, where'd that bread come? And they go, oh, well, there's a bakery across town. They baked it and they shipped it here. Okay, that's a very simple supply chain. But then let's just kind of explore that a little bit. Well, your bread, there's a wrapper. You know, is it paper or plastic? Well, either one, but it came from somewhere. Somebody had to make that. And then, oh, you say it came over from the bakery. Well, how did it get here? Well, by a truck. Well, who made the truck? And what's it run on? Well, it runs on diesel. Where did the driver come from? You know, get the training and be a driver and so forth. And then over at the bakery. Well, how do they bake the bread? Well, they have ovens. Well, ovens have, you know, tempered glass and steel and thermostats and semiconductors and probably parts from 10 different countries and had to come from some manufacturer and delivered to the bakery. And how do you bake bread? Well, you use flour. Well, where'd the flour come from? Well, it comes from a mill. How'd it get here? Well, a truck or a train. The mill made the flour. Oh, that's good. Well, what do they make it out of? Well, wheat. Where'd they get the wheat? Well, it came from a farm. Okay, where's the farm? Maybe it's in Iowa. And that had to come by train or truck to the bakery. And okay, let's flip over to the farmer. Where'd they get the seed? Where'd they get, you know, they got tractors. The tractors run on diesel. You need farmhands. And oh, by the way, you need fertilizer, nitrogen fertilizer. Where's that come from? Well, it comes from Russia, but there's a war going on with Russia. And so the fertilizer is not as available. And I could go on and on, but that's what you call the extended supply chain. And there are many, many parts to it. And by the way, every one of those, if you think of it as a kind of a horizontal extended supply chain, there are these vertical intersections, you know, the oven, the truck, the driver, the wrapper, and they all have their own supply chains. So when you really get into it, kind of the way I'm describing, you realize that, first of all, there's like a supply chain of supply chains, if you want to think of it that way, but it's infinitely complex. And that's where you can use physics, complexity theory, and understand it as a dynamic process. And that was really your question, Marshall. So yeah, you can look at individual components and they may be physical in the sense of a loaf of bread, but it's really a process of delivery, transportation lanes, technology, outsourcing, assembling parts in many different countries that keeps the whole thing going. And then, so I pretty quickly got to when I started my research, got to the conclusion, I said the supply chain is not part of the economy. The supply chain is the economy. There's nothing you can think of, or I can think of, you know, the clothes we're wearing, the books, the painting behind me, the food we eat, shows we get, whatever. That's not part of a supply chain one way or another. It's everything we do.
So here's the question, and you go into the history a bit of this. I'd love to talk about the sunken Mediterranean ship as an example. Mm-hmm. But when you're describing that bread process that quickly escalated from the local Walmart to the war in Ukraine, is there anything uniquely modern about that high degree of complexity? Or are most of the processes we're describing in that example, aside from the fact that there's obviously a digitization to that process, there's the internet. What's the story there?
Well, the answer is both. There are some uniquely modern aspects of it, and we'll talk about those. Now, look, bread's been around for, 5,000 years or since the beginning of agriculture. And you're right. In the beginning of the book, I talk about a shipwreck, a Bronze Age shipwreck from around 1200 BC, discovered off the coast of Turkey in the Mediterranean in a place called Ulubaron. It was a Turkish sponge diver who found it. He saw it was a jar, and he said it was funny looking, had ears. Well, you know, experts knew the ears were handles. You know, that's how you move the jug. Anyway, he reported it. The archaeological authorities got involved. They did a 10-year underwater excavation of the shipwreck. It was the most kind of plentiful and diverse group of Bronze Age artifacts that have ever been discovered. So on that vessel, there was amber, which comes from the Baltic Sea. There was gold, which at the time came from Sudan, not far from the equator. There were weapons, which came from present-day Syria and Israel, or Phoenicia at the time, and Damascus. There's olives and figs, which came from Italy or Spain. There's even a little carving of Queen Nefertiti, which is probably on its way to Alexandria, Egypt. But the point is, when you say, where do all those things come from? Well, if you go from the Baltic Sea to the equator and from kind of present-day Iran, Persia at the time, to Spain, I calculated this, that's an area of 5 million square miles. And all those goods were on one vessel, which was obviously at the center of this immense supply chain. So there's nothing new about supply chains. But what is new was supply chain science. And this really kind of arose in 1989. It was a combination of increased computing power, artificial intelligence, more advanced algorithms, and better data availability so that scientists and experts could actually apply that science to supply chain management and make it more efficient. Now, at the same time, 1989, you had the fall of the Berlin Wall. 1991, you had the collapse of the former Soviet Union. 1992, you had Deng Xiaoping's what's called the Southern Tour. You know, China had grown a lot in the 80s, but then they slammed on the brakes. We slammed on the brakes in 1989 after the Tiananmen Square massacre. And it took a few years to kind of get back to normal. I was actually traveling in China around that time. Couldn't find an American. There were plenty of the 91, 92, I was in central China, plenty of Brits and Germans and Australians, but no Americans to be seen. But by 1992, that got back on track. So in a fairly compressed period, from 1989 to 1992, Berlin Wall, communism, new Central Asian republics, Eastern Europe emerging with sovereignty, China opening up to the world. This was the beginning of globalization. Now, I had been involved with international transactions, international finance for decades before that. But I remember my children and their peers, you know, college age, young adults, everything was globalization. That's all they wanted to talk about. And I thought, well, isn't that what I've been doing it with international transactions? But the answer is no, globalization really was new because all of a sudden China's in the game, Russia's in the game. The science and then, you know, in time, the internet and the web and so forth. So it did create a new global trading systems, much larger. And so what we did with the applied science that I described, we had the extended supply chain. So I was talking about the loaf of bread and the farmer. Well, now the supply chains are, the lines are 9,000 miles long. They're going from Chongqing to New York or from Shanghai to Amsterdam. All in the name of efficiency. That was the driving force, efficiency. And that just basically means lower costs. And if you can get the costs lower, which you can, that's either higher profits for the participants or lower costs for the consumers, or more likely both. And, you know, Walmart was kind of the king of this. And they did that. And they did it very well. But the problem was with those, I'll call them visible savings, visible costs, which were driven down, there were invisible costs that we didn't take into account. And the number one is the fragility of the whole thing. When it's that complex and that extended, it's extremely vulnerable, lacks robustness. And you break one little part, the whole thing shuts down. And that's where we are today. We're seeing the breakdown of the global supply chain. We made them hyper-efficient, but we also made them hyper-vulnerable. And now we're seeing the breakdown.
You use this metaphor that I really enjoyed in the book. You compared a robust supply chain to health insurance. So can you explain like that idea and how it kind of undercounts the way we're thinking about these processes?
Sure. I'll give you just kind of one more example and then go directly to your point. So, you know, Germany is a great, huge car manufacturing industry. They got BMW and Volkswagen, Mercedes and Audi and all that. But it turns out that there are about 100 miles of wires in a car, you know, all the connectors and the sensors and the lights and everything you need to connect. Well, you can't just throw the wires on the front seat. You need a conduit. And there's a plastic part. It's a conduit. And it's one of the first things you put in the car. You run all the wires to it and connect it. Well, it turns out that those plastic conduits were being made in Ukraine. Well, sadly, there's a war going on in Ukraine, and all of a sudden they couldn't get those. So now you got Mercedes shutting down major assembly lines in Germany because they can't get a plastic part from Ukraine. And, you know, eventually you find another supplier and you get the whole thing moving again. But that's an example of the fragility and the lack of robustness. And the point is, again, the reason I use insurance as a metaphor, we all have homeowners insurance, liability insurance, whatever. Nobody wants their house to burn down. But if something like that happens, you're glad you have the insurance. And furthermore, when you write the check to the insurance company or, you know, pay online or whatever, you don't think you're wasting your money. You think you're paying for something, but you think what you're getting is valuable. You're getting protection against the kind of breakdowns we're talking about. And that's what I mean about supply chains. You stretch them so thin, they're vulnerable. Do you lower costs? Yeah. But you should be willing to incur some costs, spend some money, or have higher costs, basically, in order to make them stronger. And that's what's going on right now. And that's the, you know, in the book, in chapter one, I talk about, it's mostly anecdotal, what's going on. They give a story of a Junior's Cheesecake, is a famous cheesecake brand in New York. Well, it turns out cheesecake is 85% cream cheese. And they couldn't get the cream cheese, so they couldn't crank out the cheesecakes. Well, that's a real story, but a bit humorous. But there are more serious variations of that, including the baby formula shortage that arose in April of 2022. So, and then chapter two, I say, well, what actually caused it? What actually broke down? What caused it? What was the timeline, et cetera? And then in chapter three, I take the story forward and talk about the future of the supply chain. So we kind of go from start to finish. And, you know, again, Americans don't need to be told about the supply chain problems. They see it every day. But they don't know why, they don't know what, and they don't know what's coming next. And that's really where the book shines a light.
And I actually want to take a step back and go even further back in the history here, because when you're talking about globalization, folks will know that there are kind of different eras of globalization. The period before World War I was actually a very globalized world, not in the sense of digital, but in the sense that you give the example, you could be a, you know, British gent in London, and you could get access to all sorts of goods that came from throughout the world. Not everything was being made in Manchester for you. What happens throughout the rest of the century that causes that era of globalization to collapse? And would you compare what's happening now to a similar either level of precarity or like an act of collapse right now?
Yeah, I think the comparison is a good one. Again, we're living in this age of globalization. We talked about that. Well, I call this the second age of globalization. The first age of globalization went from about 1870 to 1914. The world was on a gold standard at the time. I'm not, you know, banging the table about a new gold standard, but we did have one at the time, which gave us a lot of monetary stability. And it was what you described. And there was a lot of technology then. You know, today we're all spun up about the internet or whatever, but, you know, the telephone was brand new. And, you know, Pierpont Morgan had a telephone in New York, and he could call a banker in London, underwrite bonds issued by somebody in Argentina to build a new railroad that was being purchased with UK equipment, et cetera. So that age of globalization existed. And the story you tell, which is from, you know, John Maynard Keynes, and I included it in my book, is exactly what you described. You can sit in London and order goods from all over the world, and they showed up. They didn't have Amazon, but it might take a week, but the Harrods would get them to you. That blew up overnight with the beginning of World War I. The countries went off the gold standard. They hoarded gold because they knew it would be important to fight the war. You know, obviously supply chains were disrupted. You know, international trade shrank, and it was just a brutal 4-year war. I mean, kind of 5 if you want to go out to the Treaty of Versailles. But then that was so that blew up that first stage of globalization. But it was followed by the hyperinflation in Germany, devaluation of currencies. You know, obviously the Great Depression, World War II, the Holocaust, the Cold War, you know, et cetera, all the way through until 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell. And we talked about that briefly. So the point is, you had this 70-year period from 1919, Treaty of Versailles, to 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall, when the world was had a succession of crises severe ones: economic, military, geopolitical, and then of course the Cold War. Not as much shooting, unfortunately, between the United States and Russia, but no trade either. Now, I remember in the, I think it was the late 1960s, early 1970s, Pepsi-Cola opened a bottling plant in near Moscow. You would have thought that world peace had broken out. It was like, wow, you actually get a Pepsi in Moscow. But that's how bad things were. There was no intercourse with Russia other than they were a commodity supplier. They would supply oil and wheat, and that was about it. China was completely shut off. I mean, you couldn't even go there if you were an American. And of course, that all changed. Now we have this globalization. But to your point, Marshall, we do see that system breaking down again. And the war in Ukraine is part of it, maybe a big part of it. The pandemic is part of it. And a lot of people point to that. Oh, the pandemic messed things up, and it did. And the war in Ukraine is disrupting supply chain. And that's true, too. But I show in the book that it really started in 2018, before the pandemic, with Donald Trump's tariffs on China. Donald Trump put tariffs they put them on appliances and solar modules. Now, technically, it applied to everybody, but China made like the vast majority of those things that we bought. So it was really aimed at China. So China sits there and goes, well, okay, what do we do? How do we fight back? And it turns out that they had been buying, the two biggest soybean producers in the world are the United States and Brazil. The biggest buyer is China. And China had been buying all their soybeans from the United States because they said, you're buying all this stuff from us. We got to figure out what we can buy from you just to reduce the trade deficit as much as possible. They still had a big surplus, but they were trying to shrink it as much as they could. Well, overnight, they move all their soybean business to Brazil. Well, that's not a phone call. I mean, you got dry bulk vessels. You got to increase port infrastructure. The farmers have to grow more. They need more fertilizer. And the participants, nobody wants a six-month contract. You want a five-year contract, because it's a really big deal. And then the U.S. soybean farmers are like, well, what do we do with all these soybeans? Well, it turns out that the Netherlands needed them for distribution in Europe. So we started selling them to the Netherlands. But the same thing. Now, if you're a shipper, you don't ship out of the Port of Los Angeles. You move your vessel to Houston or Savannah or Port Elizabeth in New York, as the case may be. So that's just one decision to move soybean orders. But it just scrambled global supply lanes, infrastructure, fertilizer, farming, and everything else. That's just one thing. We talked about, and so you can go down the list, and we talked about the plastic part for the needed for the cars in Germany, many, many other examples. It's breaking down all over the place. And I talked to a guy, CEO of a Fortune 10 company, probably the single most responsible individual for the creation of the modern supply chain. Now, of course, millions of people were involved in it, but his tech company really drove this process to a great extent. And he said to me, he said, Jim, you have to understand, it took us 30 years to build this. We blew it up in 3 years. It's not going to come back quickly. It's going to take 5 or 10 years or longer to build the new supply chain. And I don't like to rely on metaphors too much, but occasionally they're useful. And one example I give, if you have a beautiful, oriental vase and somebody like knocks it over and breaks it into 5,000 pieces, you don't sit there and put the pieces back together. You got to go out and get a new vase. And that's what's happened. This complex dynamic system is broken down in a lot of ways. It continues, as we mentioned with the pharmaceutical example. And we're going to have to build a new one, get a new one, but basically build a new one. But it's going to look very different. And I talk about that in chapter five of the book, in the conclusion, what the new supply chain will look like.
And actually, I want to spend a second there because I was a little confused about this. So key thing is, to your point, it's not as if we can just fix, quote unquote, the supply chain 1.0, go right back to those days. We have to build a new system after the current one collapses. Why is that true, right? Because to your point, the supply chains, it's a process. There are various parts along that process. Why can't we say reallocate the part to the car you mentioned from Ukraine to, let's say, like Vilnius or to somewhere in Western Europe? That would be, I think, an example of fixing, but that doesn't seem to be enough to your point. Like, explain that.
Correct. Well, first of all, you could do that, and they probably already have because they're not coming out of Ukraine. But then something will go wrong in Vilnius, or they can't get the chemicals they need to make the plastic, et cetera. So this is the problem of complex dynamic systems. I could give you 100 examples. You've just given a few, but it's kind of endless. Just as the supply chain complexity is, you know, theoretically, it's not literally infinite, but theoretically infinite is one way to model it. There's no end to it. It's the way I describe it. You know, the waterfall comes out, but the water doesn't go back up the waterfall. It just keeps going. But there are also huge geopolitical aspects to this. You know, we're decoupling from China. Yeah, but China's decoupling from us. This is like a divorce. Both sides want out of this thing, and they're going to get it. So what I envision, as I say, going the point of the Bronze Age example was that we always have supply chains. The question is, what do they look like and how do they work? So the new supply chain, we're going to create what I call a College of Nations. And other people have different phrases for it. Janet Yellen calls it friendshoring. Emmanuel Macron calls it a constellation of nations. But the basic idea is we'll have trading partners and we'll have outsourcing, but it'll be a group of kind of like-minded nations. So what will they have in common? Democracies, you know, kind of liberal, good rule of law, respect for human rights, et cetera. So that would be, you know, with all our faults, you know, U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Western Europe. I would include India in this group. I think they'll be part of it as well. And they'll trade with each other. So you'll still have outsourcing and transportation links, but it'll be confined. It'll be more compact. That means fewer things can go wrong. Will it be a little more expensive? Probably, but it'll be more robust. And that goes back to writing the insurance check. You don't think you're wasting your money. You're getting something for the added cost. Now, China is going to have to do the same thing with far fewer points of intersection. By the way, we already see this happening in a big way with Apple. They've already announced that they're moving have moved some of their iPhone 13 production to India. You're going to see a lot more going India's way. And you can't uproot these things overnight. I mean, Foxconn, they don't make the iPhone in China. They assemble it. The parts come from Apple's disclosed, 26 or more countries. You know, the Gorilla Glass comes from Japan. Semiconductors come from South Korea. The other parts come from Germany, et cetera. So you can't unscramble that overnight, but they're going to start to move in that direction. But I'll give you a very concrete example. So Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, TSMC, largest and most sophisticated semiconductor manufacturer in the world by far. They've just announced $40 billion on four separate new semiconductor fabrication plants, what they call fabs, in Arizona. Now, they could build them in Taiwan. They could probably build them in China. Why are they building them in Arizona? Well, they're looking at China, and they have to consider the possibility of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. And that's a whole other story, getting into the peak China theory and all that. But the U.S. military has a doctrine called the broken nest theory. And ironically, it's based on a Chinese proverb. But the proverb is, if the nest is broken, how can the eggs survive? And the answer is they can't. And as applied to Taiwan Semiconductor in Taiwan, if China invades, the U.S. military is going to destroy all the Taiwan semiconductor facilities, destroy them, burn them to the ground, blow them up, whatever it takes, because we don't want those to fall into the hands of the Chinese, because that would be a massive technological leapfrog by them. Well, if I know it, you know, and our audience knows it, Taiwan semiconductors know it. And that's why they're moving to Arizona, so that they can survive as a company, even in the face of that. So this then leads to an assessment of, okay, so if the new supply chains look more compact, like-minded nations, kind of a club, I call it the College of Nations, and China will have their own. If that's the way the world is going, you know, who are the winners and losers? Because that's important to investors, and I talk about that. Well, one of the winners will be the United States. I mean, in the short run, I think we're in it for a very severe recession in 2023. But longer term, 3 years, 5 years out, the U.S. will do quite well. I think India will do quite well. I mean, people had these weird notions of developing economies. India is the largest democracy in the world. I mean, 1.4 billion people. They're going to pass China if they haven't already. They've been a democracy since independence. Great tech skills. They were on the socialist path for a while, but they've done a lot of reforms, much more capitalistic. So India is going to be a go-to place and displace China in many ways for direct foreign investment. But the U.S. is going to get a lot of this investment coming our way. The fact that you can't get Tamiflu and ibuprofen from China right now, well, that's a good reason to make it here. It's not that we don't know how to do it. So it's going to be more compact, more robust, maybe a little more expensive initially, but it'll be worth it because it will be sustainable, whereas the relationship with China is not.
So two or three last questions in this section, then I want to kind of go to the part where you debunk a lot of the, let's say, conventional wisdom around the past two or three years, which I thought was very, very, very valuable. But question one, so you made the point that, you know, things are going to be more expensive, but, you know, that's the price of robustness, of resiliency. But you kind of make it literal, like what's something that the Marshall Kozloff of, let's say, 2026, what's something that I will miss from that supply chain? Because I was born in 1992. So the timeline you describe is my entire life up until COVID, really. Like what is something I will miss despite the robustness during this 2.0 era?
That's a great question. I don't think you'll miss much. I do think that, you know, direct foreign investment is going to get scrambled. Job creation is going to get scrambled. Educational opportunities, technology, et cetera. Costs may be a little higher in the short run. They may be lower in the long run because we don't have some of these failures that we're seeing right now. I'd say Chinese food, but, you know, I live in New England. I live in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. We have great Chinese restaurants. We have the best sushi. The fish comes right off the boat. So I'm not even going to be missing, foodstuffs, for example, that might come from China. And people can still move. You know, that's why I've never accepted the theory of comparative advantage. I think David Ricardo was a great economist, but the thing he missed, and he kind of said it in his own lifetime, although the modern PhDs seem to overlook it, is that you can create comparative advantage out of thin air by moving assets, moving capital around. And so people move and people have talent. They're gonna want to go where the action is. I mean, why are all the big tech brands around San Jose, or why are so much medical research around Raleigh, North Carolina? Well, you want to be with people doing what you're doing and share ideas and share and have a community. So those will get shuffled around a little bit, but there'll be some losses, but there'll be a lot of opportunity. So I don't know if travel opportunities might be impinged. I mean, I've been to China quite a few times, and not, you know, downtown Beijing. I go out, I've got, you know, I would say I got mud on my boots, but I was wearing Italian loafers. But I went out to construction sites for the ghost cities. I've been to, you know, Wuhan, believe it or not, and Chongqing, Xi'an, Nanjing, and a lot of places in between. I don't know whether that might be more restricted in the future, which would be too bad, because whether you like a government or not, you ought to go meet the people and see the country when you can. But I guess a variation on your question, Marshall, is a great question. But a variation on that, it used to be we could discuss the economy and we could discuss geopolitics, and I have a pretty good background on both. And they've always had some relationship, but today they're so intertwined, you almost can't break them apart. You can't have the discussion we're having without talking about the war in Ukraine, or Chinese invasion of Taiwan, or Chinese confrontation with the United States in the South China Sea. And then COVID doesn't respect borders. I mean, it goes everywhere. I would say, I'm optimistic about reforming supply chains along the lines we discussed. I think U.S., India, and some other countries will be winners. I think China will be a big loser for a lot of other reasons we haven't discussed, including demographics.
Yeah, let's have up our last section then. Like, so we talked about the winners, like losers. Let's go there.
Well, let's start with China. So the myth is, you know, the 20th century was the American century, and the 21st century is going to be the Chinese century. You know, they're way ahead of us in population. They're going to pass us in GDP, just a matter of time. Technological innovation, productivity, low cost, building out the military, et cetera. They're going to dominate, you know, at least be a Western Pacific hegemon, if not the global power. Everything I just said is not true. I mean, that's the rap. But the truth is the following. 50% of the water in China is poisoned. And I don't mean dirty, like you got to clean it up. I mean poisoned. I love the familiarity with the mining industry. Your U.S. and Canada, when you're leaching gold out of ore, you use cyanide. Well, you got to weigh the cyanide before you use it. You got to cache it all and then weigh it when you're done. And they better be the same. You can't be dumping the cyanide. In China, they do. They just run it into the rivers. The rivers are poisoned. Most of it's desert, high plateau, mountains. Anyway, you know, you pick your rice paddies. Well, that's like a little 20% section of southeastern China. So the water's poisoned. They're in what's called the middle income trap. They got where they are. You know, when I studied development economics in the 70s, we used to think the hard part was going from poor to middle income. But once you got there, you were on your way to high income. Turns out that's not true. The getting from poor to middle income is pretty straightforward. People come from rural areas to cities and you do assembly style manufacturing. You're there. Getting from middle income to high income, that's hard because you need more high value added productivity. You need a lot of technology and the Chinese can't do it on their own. They steal from us, but that's pretty much over. We're shutting that down. So they're kind of stuck in this middle income trap. The real estate sector is bankrupt. And their biggest problem, and this is a 50-year problem, but it's starting now, is demographic. They're going to lose 600 million people in the next 60 years between now between now and 2100. They're going to lose 600 million people. The population is going to go from 1.4 billion to approximately 800 million. Now, I can give you a lot of definitions of GDP, but the easiest one is how many people are working and how productive are they? Just labor force times productivity, there's your GDP. How do you knock 600 million people out of your labor force and grow at all? You don't. You're going to collapse. And not only that, it's worse than that, because the reason...
What role does automation play in like making up for that?
Well, robots don't do best. The problem is they not only have a declining population because the birth rate is probably 1. They say 1.7. 2.1 is a replacement birth rate. Two people have 2.1 kids, counting for infant mortality, et cetera. That keeps you steady. They're at best 1.7. That's what they say. Probably closer to 1, according to some studies. So no one's having kids, basically. But it's worse than that because the people who are alive are getting older. And when you get into your 70s, 80s, and 90s, there's a very high correlation. Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's disease, all three of those diseases and others like it are incurable. They're progressive. They get worse with age, which means that not only do you have that part of the population non-productive, you have to take another part of the population as caregivers for the elderly population who are suffering from mental decline. Now, that's a very worthy occupation, but there are no productivity gains in that. Like I say, other than around 1870 to 1940, we came up with indoor plumbing and hot water. Nice. But nothing since. And as I say, robots don't do best. So you're taking people who could be doing other things. They have to be caregivers for the old. The old can't do anything because they're suffering from cognitive decline, which means, and your population is declining anyway because the birth rate's not replacing it. So you're getting a smaller and smaller group who can actually do stuff. Now, yeah, automation can help. I don't dispute that, but you can't replace 600 million workers with robots, maybe a few. So the point is, China's in a long-term decline for a lot of reasons, including some I haven't mentioned. They are the second largest economy in the world. They're a big player, no question about it. But when you take the second biggest player and put them in the condition I just described, see, the U.S. deals with it. We have a low birth rate also, but we deal with it through immigration. I don't want to get into the immigration debate. That's another big one. But we do have millions of people coming into the country, and they work. That's how we keep up. Europe is doing it with immigration from Eastern Europe and now Ukraine. 3 to 4 million Ukrainians have gone to Poland, and they'll end up in Germany or France or UK or someplace. Doesn't do a lot of good for Ukraine. But the point is, that's a huge problem for the 21st century, a huge problem for the global economy, and makes China the biggest loser in the future of the supply chain.
So last question, I really like your point around how geopolitics and economics are just so tied together. I'm thinking of, Thomas Friedman, the world is flat, that book had nothing to do with the Iraq war. You would not have to compare those two geopolitical, that economic phenomenon with the geopolitical event. You can't tell this story without talking about the war in Ukraine to a certain degree. Right. What would be your takeaway on the geopolitical side of things? Toning down relations, not letting economic conflict escalate to military conflict. Let's close there. What would your advice be?
Sure. People ask me all the time, in interviews like this and other fora, what's the greatest threat out there? We talked about it. We talked about climate change and COVID and China and everything else. The greatest threat is way too high, is nuclear war. I studied this beginning in the late 1960s, and the scholars that I studied then, this is in the middle of the Cold War, a lot of the work was done in the late 1950s. It was Herman Kahn on thermonuclear war, Henry Kissinger, Albert Wohlstetter, Paul Nitzer. They all did a lot of work on this. I studied it, and they had different perspectives, counterforce, countervalue, first strike, second strike. But they all said the same thing. They said, don't go there. And what they meant was, don't escalate. Nobody wakes up and says, hey, nice day. I think I'll start a nuclear war. I'll shoot missiles, do what happens. That's not how it happens. It happens, somebody does something, somebody else raises the ante, they strike back, and it keeps escalating. And it gets to a point where somebody feels an existential threat. One side or the other feels that, you know what, you're now threatening my regime, you're threatening my country. I have no choice. I run out of options. I'm going to use nuclear weapons. Or they're coming to that conclusion. Now, here's where it gets really interesting, because you take a game theoretic approach. The side that doesn't want to shoot the nuclear weapons shoots first. Because if you think the other guy's going to shoot first, it's to your advantage to shoot first yourself. So the guy who wasn't even thinking about it ends up shooting the nuclear weapons first because they think the other guy's going to move next. And they don't want to wait for that to happen. They don't want to have to shoot the second strike. They want the first strike. So the answer to that, and we learned this in the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember that. I was like, 10, 11 years old. I remember the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer, the newspaper. They had a map of the Northern Hemisphere, kind of Western part of the Northern Hemisphere, and concentric circles around emanating from Cuba, showing the distance that different missiles can go. And the first thing you did was look at your neighborhood, like, am I in one of those circles? And we were, We had air bomb shelters and everything else. But they backed off. Khrushchev and Kennedy backed off. He said, all right, I'll stop sending the missiles, but you take your Jupiter missiles out of Turkey and US, you agree not to invade Cuba. And we did, and we backed down and avoided nuclear war. Today, unfortunately, the Biden administration, the warmongers, Victoria Nuland, Tony Blinken, Jake Sullivan, Susan Rice, I don't count Biden very much because he's in my Chinese dementia category, but all the people around him are genuine warmongers. And same thing in the UK, by the way, Boris Johnson, now the new prime minister, are going that way. All this knowledge seems to have been lost. It's kind of like we stopped thinking about nuclear war after 1989, but now it's on the table again, with the one exception, which is this new generation. They're in their 40s or 50s in some cases. They haven't been trained, kind of the way I was describing. And I think it's kind of like a checker or chess piece on the chessboard, but they don't understand this escalatory danger. They think they can step up to the brink and somehow either intimidate Russia or pull it back a little bit. And that's a mistake. And every day, the other day, Ukraine launched strikes deep inside Russia and struck a Russian airbase. Well, people go, well, there's a war on, they got invaded, so can't they shoot back? Well, I guess. But if you're shooting drone missiles at Russian air bases in Russia, you have now escalated. And Russia retaliated by saying, we're not just going to disrupt your infrastructure, we're going to burn it to the ground. You're going to freeze in the dark. And that is happening in Ukraine. So what's next? What will Victoria Nuland throw at the Russians next? They want this war. The U.S. wants this war. Well, they got it. But you are dealing with a nuclear power, and on both sides, because of the United States, of course. So that danger is way higher than it should be. The Russians understand it. The U.S., we just don't have the talent anymore. They don't seem to understand it. They think it's a plaything, and the risks are way too high.
So the takeaway then would be relearn the lessons of 50s, 60s, Cold War nuclear weapons theory. James, this has been Really helpful. Thank you for joining me on The Realignment. Can you just shout the book out? It's always best when the author does that rather than me on the script.
Sure. Thank you very much. The book is called Sold Out. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and your local bookstore. I'm happy to say we're number one Amazon bestseller. We're just out the other day. This is launch week. We're very excited. We'll see where the chips fall in terms of the bestseller list, but you know, always optimistic. But it's Sold Out. About broken supply chains and a lot more, including inflation and deflation. Thank you.
Best of luck with the rest of the tour. Thank you for joining me on the show.
Thanks.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.